about space, you know, and that's where I got in trouble. I said I was John Q from outer space. And I found out one thing, we must never land, you know, just one at a time. And I've seen a lot of saucer people, but I can't talk about it, you know, because back in the zoo. So we just got to wait, you know, until 1985, and then, oh, yeah, freeze those cats in the street on the streetcars and everything else. But I can hold off. I've got a little magazine article, 1985, coming out there in the Popular Mechanics. You'll see it in the April issue, and it's all there. But I thought, there is a lot of talk about flying saucers, and I want you to meet a man this evening that's actually seen some 300 flying saucers. And your name, sir?
My name's Elwood P. Suggins, and I'm from Bellbrook, Ohio.
Mm-hmm. And you've seen some 300 flying saucers, is that right, sir?
Yes, that is very true.
When did you see your last flying saucer?
The last one I seen was here Sunday week. It was out in a wheat field.
In a wheat field. Isn't that a little unusual?
No, I think they must feed off wheat or something.
I see. Can you describe the saucer to us?
Oh, very easily. I've seen over 300 of them. It's about as big as this here room. And when it come down, it give off a real funny whirring sound. And the heat it give off was just intense. It was intense. Me and my kid was there, and it was fierce. It's fierce.
I see. And then what happened, Mr. Sutton?
Well, when this here door opened up, and this little ladder come down, and this here teeny man come down this here ladder.
Wait a minute, Mr. Suggins. When you say teeny, what do you mean by teeny?
Well, like I say, he come down this here ladder and crossed over the road and reached up and milked my cow like this. I'd call that teeny, wouldn't you?
Yes, I would, Mr. Suggins. Well, did he speak American? Did he speak English?
Yes, he did. He had this here glass head on him, and there's a little armature inside, and he went,
"Hello, I'm a Martian. I hope I speak your language. This is a recording."
And then what happened, Mr. Suggins?
Well, then I waited for the flip side.
"Take me to your leader. Take me to your leader."
And did you take him to your leader?
No, I didn't know who my leader was.
I see. Did he do anything else?
Yes, he did. Every time my kid come out of the house, he shrunk him. Shrunk him down about that size. And every time I let the dog out, the dog had buried him 3 times. I figure at least he could have did was shrink a dog so a kid has somebody to play with.
I see. Was there anything else?
Well, and he just, dissolved a couple of chickens around the house, I suppose, for kicks. And then he got on this here ladder again, opened that little door. See, and he was... And then just after he left, there was something worked off on my body, a sort of radiation or something. And I commenced to shrink myself. It was just terrible.
Well, Mr. Suggins, wait a minute. Mr. Suggins, what's the matter?
There you go. There you go, boys and girls. That's Jonathan Winters from way back. I hope a lot of you remember Jonathan Winters, one of the funniest guys around. Anyhow, the reason I played that was because about 3 o'clock in the morning, I tuned in on the radio, and they said there was an unidentified object landed on the president's White House lawn. And they thought it was a drone, maybe a drone, but I think it was a flying saucer. I think Flying Saucer came there, wanted to talk to Obama, but Obama's over in India. But I haven't heard any more about it today, and maybe they squashed it. What do you think? Yeah. Well, most people don't remember Jonathan Winters, but hopefully there's some of you people out there still do. He was one of the most terrific comedians back in the 60s and the 70s that there was. And also, you might remember he played in the movie, the great comedy movie, one of the greatest comedy movies. Now I forgot what it was. There I got it. Mad World. And Jonathan Winters played a guy that was driving a moving van in that film. If you haven't seen Mad World, you got to see it. Yeah, I think it's the funniest movie ever made. Well, here we are, P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. All day, that's right. Beautiful, sunshiny day. Beautiful, no rain today. Oh, we get a break for a change. And don't forget to go up to our big website that gets thousands of hits a month. People getting educated on the race issue. Yeah, that's right, man. The media are trying to forget that we exist, but thousands of people go to that website every month and get educated, get partially educated anyhow. Well, yesterday I dropped into the local newspaper like I do once in a while just to bug them, and I just unannounced walk into the newsroom, and there's the editor. And the editor, I always give him hell, and in a tongue-in-cheek kind of way, and all the cub reporters in there, I get them laughing. And I said, "Hey, man, you still are not printing my letters there, Mr. Editor Man." I said, is it the owners or somebody above you?" He said, "Oh, no, it's me." I said, well, why don't you print any of my letters?" He said, "Well, the problem is bad taste." I said, "There's nothing in the news that's good taste. All the news is bad taste, if you ask me." So I told him about my trip over to Israel and a couple of things like that. Handed him a picture of my big sign out front that I'm sure makes him happy. I get probably more people reading that sign out in front of my house than take the newspaper anyhow. So I said, further ado, I'm getting out of here, man. Leave this rag to you." And the date is, guess what? July the 1st, 2015. How about that? Full moon. Full moon, too, tonight. Yeah. The only thing I dread about this, a couple of things I dread about this 4th of July stuff coming up is the phoniness of it. The absolute phoniness of 4th of July. And the other thing is everybody's exploding all these fireworks all over the place, and there's a whole lot of companies selling fireworks everywhere you look, and they're all coming out of China, of course. So here we go making China rich while we celebrate the pretty much phony holiday, the 4th of July. The more I study history, the more I think we'd have been probably better off for a while with the Articles of Confederation and sticking closer to England. I think that's my opinion. I think all that killing was somewhat of a waste of time, white people killing white people again. Get those red coats and yeah, all that kind of stuff. So anyhow, look, being Terrible Tommy, I look into terrible things and report to you terrible news and give you some terrible funny stuff, too, and funny jokes, terrible jokes. I'm going to go back into the good old days book, They Were Terrible, and let's see what we can dig up now. Something that the press doesn't talk about, the old days. They like to gloss over all the bad old terrible days in this country and pretend everything was all hunky-dory and kids weren't working 12, 14 hours a day, young little kids on machinery, and there was not a lot of pretty much wage slavery and all that kind of stuff. They talk about the blacks. Oh, the poor blacks. Well, believe me, whites had it just as bad in most cases. Just as bad. White working people. Well, I should have started this book at the beginning yesterday instead of in the middle. So I'm going to go back to the first part of it, the introduction, and we'll go from there. The good old days, were they really good? On the surface, they appeared to be so, especially the period which this term is most often applied, the years from the end of the Civil War to early 1900s. an interesting bookcased in, you know, Civil War at one end, World War I at the other end. This period of history has receded into the benevolent haze, leaving us with the image of a ebullient, carefree America, the fun and charm of the Gilded Age and the gay 90s. Not referring to homosexuals, back when people could really be gay once in a while. But this gaiety was only a brittle veneer that covered the widespread turmoil and suffering. The good old days were good for but the privileged few, the ruling class, the moneyed elite, the 1 or 2% of the population. For the farmer, the laborer, the average breadwinner, life was an unremitting hardship. This segment of the populace was exploited or lived in the shadow of total neglect, and youth had no voice. These are the people, the mass of Americans, whose adversities this book attempts to chronicle. Such an endeavor may come as a surprise to those who are familiar with my work. The files of the Bettman Archive bulge with graphics of what we call the Golden Past. Many do indeed exude an aura of charm and well-being, but there are so many others less in demand, which gives us a totally different picture. I've always felt that our times have overrated and unduly overplayed the fun aspects of the past. What we've forgotten are the hunger of the unemployed, crime, corruption, the despair of the aged, the insane, and the crippled. The world now gone was in no way spared the problems we consider horrendous our own, such as pollution, addiction, urban plight, or educational turmoil. Most of our nostalgia books, such crises are ignored, and the period's dirty business is swept under the carpet of oblivion. What emerges is a glowing picture of the past, of the blue-skied meadows where children play and millionaires sip tea. If we compare this purported Arcadia with our own days, we cannot but feel a jarring discontent, a sense of despair, that fate has dropped us into the worst of all possible worlds. And the future, once the resort of hopeful dreams, is envisioned as an abyss filled with apocalyptic nightmares. My post at the picture window of history has given me a more optimistic, if less fashionable, vista. I have concluded that we have to revise the idealized picture of the past and turn the spotlight on its grimmer aspects. The more realistic approach will show us the gay 90s man, the man in the street, not in the boardroom, as one to be pitied rather than envied. We could but dream of the utopian miracles that have become part of our everyday life. Compared with him, we are lucky, even if dire premonitions darken our days and we find much to bemoan in our society. Proceeding from such convictions, this may be called a missionary book, a modest personal attempt to redeem our times from the aspersions cast upon them by nostalgic comparisons. It is a supplemental revisionary view I offer, necessarily sketchy because of the boundlessness of the subject and the tyranny of book pages that refuse to stretch. Even if we cast but a cursory glance at the not-so-good-old days and bring them into the alignment with our own, we will find much to be grateful for. We're going forward, if but slowly. This fact should move us to view the future in less cataclysmic terms, the future that will see man, in Faulkner's words, not only endure but prevail. First, we're going to talk about the air. You know, we talk about air all the time. You know, we want fresh air. We've got to clean up the air. And the air is fouled with coal smoke and oil smoke and everything. When the Civil War ended, American North was fully mobilized for industry,
and forests of smokestacks had grown along with its swelling cities. This was a period of confidence as the country set out boldly to shape a new destiny. On the back of wage slavery, let me submit, the smoke that billowed over the landscape was seen as a good omen. It meant prosperity. In the industrial communities, it was considered a sign of feminine delicacy to complain about the bad air or to have a coughing spell. Mary Gilson, growing up in Pittsburgh in the 1890s, was reprimanded by her parents for complaining about the foul air. Quote, "We should be grateful for God's goodness in making work, which made smoke, which made prosperity," unquote. And also made weather change. The intense pollution was thus rationalized by its victims, and many doctors had only a hazy notion of its effects. Some went so far as to declare that smoke with carbon, sulfur, and iodine in it acted as a curative for lung and cutaneous diseases, and that it killed malaria. So, the more smoke and other crap in the air, you should be healthier. There were other forms of... Sounds like the cigarette industry up until the... When was it? The 80s? Cigarettes are good for you. They even had doctors advertising that Camels and Chesterfields were great. I remember a friend of mine in the Army. We were in the same room together. And he was a Chesterfield smoker. And every morning he'd swing out of his rack, sitting on the edge of the bed, the Army cot, and he'd cough for about at least 5 minutes, maybe 10, before he got up to do anything else. Every morning he did that. I know he must have died a long time ago, but that was the case. There were other forms of pollution that made life in certain parts of the city unhealthy and degrading. Well, not as bad as London was way back in Charles Dickens' time. unhealthy and degrading streets caked with animal wastes and oozings of clogged sewers and littered with overflow of uncollected garbage that was piled on the sidewalks. The emanating stenches combined to make New York, in the words of one visitor, a nasal disaster. Four-legged polluters when pigs roamed Broadway. Broadway's affinity with ham has an enduring quality. In the 1860s, however, two species competed for attention in the heart of the city, one panting on stage, the other squealing and grunting in the streets. The pig in the city was a paradox, an element of rural culture transposed to urban life. Pigs roamed the streets rooting for food, the stink from their waste poisoning the air. Because they ate garbage, the pigs were tolerated to a degree in the absence of adequate sanitary facilities. But this and also they would clean up and eat dead bodies, too. A lot of people don't realize that pigs are the best animal to get rid of bodies. It was rumored that Peter Pitches, the sheriff of Los Angeles County, for years had a pig farm. And it was rumored that not only he, but somehow his connections with the mob, they would dump their bodies in this with the pigs, and the pigs would eat everything, the bones and everything. So, but whether he did or not, and whether that's true or not, it's true that a pig will devour the whole body, the bones and everything, if you want to get rid of evidence. But this dubious contribution to municipal services was tiny in comparison with the nuisance they caused. From the nation's capital to Midwestern Porkopolis, we are told squares and parks amounted to public hog pens. Urbana, Illinois boasted more hogs in the city than people. The human dwellings of Cincinnati in the 1860s commingled with 50 slaughterhouses, which drew a yearly mess of almost 500,000 pigs through the streets. And in Kansas City, the confusion and the stench of patrolling hogs were so penetrating that Oscar Wilde observed, quote, "They made granite eyes weep." Cincinnati, 450,000 porkers pass through the city each year. Yeah. Equine smells. In the city streets clogged with automobiles, the vision of a horse and buggy produces strong nostalgia. A century ago, it produced a different feeling, distress, owing to the horse for what he dropped and to the buggy for spreading it. Of the 3 million horses in the American cities at the beginning of the 20th century, New York had some 150,000. The healthier ones, each producing between 20 and 25 pounds of shit a day. Those are my words. He said manure, I say plain shit. These dumplings were numerous on every street, attracting swarms of flies and radiating a powerful stench. The ambiance was further debased by the presence on almost every block of stables filled with urine-saturated hay.
Ugh.
During dry spells, the pounding traffic refined the manure to dust, which blew from the pavement as a sharp, piercing powder to cover your clothes, ruin our furniture, and blow up into our nostrils. The 15,000 horses of Rochester, New York, produced enough manure in 1900 to cover an acre of ground with a layer 175 foot high. This steadily increased the production, caused the more pessimistic observers to fear that American cities would disappear like Pompeii, but not under ashes. The timely arrival of the horseless carriage prevented this, of course. It was widely hoped that the age of polluted air was coming to the close, that cities at long last would be healthier, cleaner, quieter places to live. But as Proudhon once observed, now he was a famous anarchist, you should read his book. He did not agree and he fought with the Marxist. But Proudhon was a pretty great individual. Human history has a great propensity for surprises, is what he said. Okay, turn the page. Industrial vapors. They ensnared New York City, Hunter's Point, a smelly scandal. Smog is a portmanteau word. Smoke plus fog, that a Glasgow sanitary engineer coined in 1905. Its widespread use today makes it seem new, but the phenomenon it describes has long existed. Smoke and acrid vapors smothered the industrial cities of post-Civil War USA, and municipal control of offending plants was as sparse as clean air in lower Manhattan. As the largest city with 287 foundries and machine shops, a printing industry powered by 125 steam engines, bone mills, refineries, and tanneries, New York in 1880 was at one time both major sinner and major victim, symbolizing the unpleasant aspects of industrialization that her sister cities also endured. The crux of the New York's filthy air was Hunter's Point on the rim of the Bronx, where established industries had moved in force by the late 1870s. Out of sight, perhaps, but not out of smell, grievous odors from the point poured over Manhattan, affecting all who lived there, regardless of rank or address. You know, this is why every time I go to town at a certain time of day here in Warsaw, I go by asbestos, or it used to be anyhow, where they made brake linings, where my mother and father worked for several years. And every time I go past a certain area in the morning, not so much in the afternoon, I get a whiff of this stuff, just like I used to when I happened to be in a car with my mother and father going by the plant back in the 40s. And it's still the same crap, but I assume they've got all kinds of equipment on to take care of it, but it doesn't seem so because I keep smelling that asbestos. Luckily, it's only in a few block area where I don't understand why people would want to live there. Frederick Law Olmsted, architect of New Central Park, complained that the stench was borne to his residence in 46th Street between 7th and 8th Avenues. But by 1881, even the doggedly patient New Yorkers had coughed enough and angrily compelled the State Board of Health to investigate the origin of their misery. That also reminds me that the sewers used to spill out into creeks and rivers all over the country. I remember just at the edge of this town, Warsaw, there was a creek, we called it Shit Creek, and the big pipe would come out there and dump into the creek. Yeah, just a regular creek. And you could sit there and see all the turds and everything else coming out. Yeah, and that was in my lifetime. During the inquiry, of course, they've cleaned it up now, and they've got all the sanitary deals and everything. It's no longer Shit Creek. It's actually returned pretty much to a pristine creek. During the inquiry, 90 witnesses specified the ingredients that gave the city air its rich flavor: sulfur, ammonia gases, offal rendering, bone boiling, manure heaps, putrid animal waste, fish scrape, kerosene, acid fumes, phosphate fertilizer, and sludge. Such an impressive menu enforced the board's conclusion that pollution was harming the citizens' health. May be why people used to die about 40 years old. 40 years old was considered old. In their testimony, a number of doctors spoke of the violence of the stenches, of the oil refineries endlessly puffing black smoke, quote, to produce sickness and depression, of acid fumes, irritated lungs and throat, of odors causing an inclination to vomit. It's a wonder anybody lived beyond 16. New Yorkers didn't call it smog in the good old days, and perhaps they were wise. Considering what they breathe daily, the word sounds almost inoffensive. To flee the city for the suburbs in the Gilded Age was often a case of leaving the frying pan for the fire. The miasma from ungraded swampy lands where family refuse decomposed in the sun made living conditions dismal. Municipal services were non-existent, and the dingy, dirty tentacles of Hunter's Point stretched to the furthermost shack. Which reminds me, up until I went into the Army at 18, I had the use at our house of an outside toilet. We never had an inside toilet. And I took my baths in a big metal steel tub, heated the water on top of a coal burning stove. So when you hear these niggers complaining about their terrible lives, well, you can tell them about Terrible Tommy. I didn't consider it terrible because, you know, you don't think of it at the time as something that's really bad. And I don't think it was really bad. It was clean, and outside toilets, you poured lime down the outside toilet, and that kept the flies and other things down. The only thing that used to worry me was getting bit on the ass by a spider or something. It was always that fear. And in the wintertime, your eyes turned brown because, in my case, I had about 75 feet or so to go through the snow to get to the outhouse. You didn't want the outhouse too close to the main house, so you'd have to go out there and dig a trench through the snow to the outhouse. So you wake up in the middle of the night and you'd have to put on a heavy coat and over your pajamas and earmuffs and a hat and take your shovel if it had a new snow and make your trail to the outhouse. I will say we had one of the fancier store-bought outhouses. In Glen Cove, Long Island, according to the Board of Health records, the atmosphere was so polluted at times as to produce nausea and make normal breathing difficult. In fear for their health, summer residents petitioned the governor for redress. Garbage revisited. Some streets smell like bad eggs dissolved in ammonia. In terms of refuse, the human is the richest animal, a fact that is hardly concealed even today by an efficient sanitation system. It was most clearly evident, however, in the American cities of the 1860s through the 1880s, where man was surrounded by his own litter, much as a champion is surrounded by his own trophies. What garbage pickup did exist was capricious and inept. Again, we turn to the New York as our model city to describe the golden age of garbage. The wastes of daily life, including kitchen slops, cinders, coal dust, horse manure, broken cobblestones, and dumped merchandise, were piled high on the sidewalks. There was hardly a block in downtown Manhattan that a pedestrian could negotiate without climbing over a heap of trash in the rain, wading through a bed of slime. This endemic mess dramatized how poorly equipped and authorities were to cope with the problem that developed cities encountered after the Civil War. You see, that's another case where the super-rich capitalists of the day, the robber barons, didn't want to put any money back into the problems of the working class. They would move to the outskirts of wherever they're at. They would build giant homes along the ocean and things like that, and have a cadre of serfs to haul away their peapots and so forth. So what did they care about the problems of the working class in the cities and in the country? They didn't give a shit, to use the word loosely. The tumbling disorder caused by the overcrowding, the cross purposes of commercial and domestic needs, and the lack of regulation overwhelmed the meager facilities that were available. There could have been a lot more done if that 1 or 2% had wanted to leave loose of some of that money they had collected. If liberty had an antic face, it leered from the sidewalks of New York. Inflation compounded the difficulty of cleanup. In the northern cities, contractors reneged on their agreements as the currency, like the air, sank in value. The conditions were even worse in southern towns, such as Memphis and New Orleans, where sewage facilities were more primitive and municipal supervision criminally lax. Well, there you go, the good old days in down south. Probably were more dangerous than a lot of the Negroes were. New York sidewalks were lined with unharnessed trucks, beneath and between which dirtier citizens threw their filth. A foreign visitor said of this antique parking problem that it made the city look like a huge, dirty stable. The wagons were coveted as a refuge by lovers and criminals, and one truck was distinguished by providing overnight shelter for the newly arrived Joseph Pulitzer. An 1895 ordinance to prohibit the parking nuisance was impeded by truckmen who removed a wheel from their vehicles to prevent the city from towing them away. We can only speculate what such spirited fellows might have done to a parking meter. Yeah, this book shows a lot of pictures, too. I'm going to check the book companies and see whether it's still available. I'd like to send some of these books to the POWs. Now to the wind. In nature's scheme of things, the wind is a messenger. It will carry with perfect fidelity to natural laws the scent of lilac or volcanic ash. And what man writes in the wind will be delivered back to him with immutable certainty. During the headlong celebration of industrial power that marked the Gilded Age, man rode in it with septic muck, and the wind carried it straight back to him, to his nostrils and eyes and lungs. In the opinion of Leslie's Weekly magazine in 1881, quote, "No dumping ground, no sewer, no vault contains more filth or in greater variety than does the air in certain parts of New York City during the long season of drought. No barrier can shut it out. No social distinction can save us from it. No domestic cleanliness, no private sanitary measures can substitute a pure atmosphere for a foul one." A lot of you probably know this, but that's why perfumes were invented. Clothes were dirty. They didn't have dry cleaners and things. And this is Europe and the United States both, in which people smelled. They stank of sweat and everything else. So they used massive amounts of perfume to cover up the stench. Anyhow, that's an interesting concept. Going out on a date, you know, it reminds me of one time in Germany. I and some of our guys used to go to this little village. It was way off the beaten track, because the MPs and military police and so forth would not bother us there. We could drink all night and not worry about it. However, the girls that worked in this bar, that were, some were prostitutes, some weren't, but the point was they did not bathe very often, and the stench was pretty good. So one night, I went down there with the boys, and I took one of these air freshener spray cans that you use in the toilet, and I went around and had all the gals lift their arms and spray under their arms with that disinfectant. And they said okay. They didn't get angry or offended or anything. In fact, they seemed to think it smelled pretty good. As warm-blooded creatures, we have always had more success coping with cold than with heat. The air conditioner, blessing that it is, alters but does not reverse the fact. Nevertheless, in hot weather, we are cooler today by several degrees without artificial help than the city dwellers of the past. The record shows that the good old summer days were often unbearable, indoors and out. New York City, for instance, was hotter then, with lower buildings that offered little protection from the sun. And the clothing of the period, heavy suits, long underwear, starched shirts plus vests, girdles, and voluminous petticoats, I think that was mostly inspired by the over-conservative religious churches. Girdles and voluminous petticoats added a penitential excess to the citizens' misery. Of course, obviously, nudity or anything like that was the devil's work. Delirium and sunstroke were commonplace. A heat wave in August 1896 caused the deaths of some 3,000 humans and 2,000 horses. The windowless room was another feature of the city life that exacerbated summer hardships. An 1894 survey found 6,576 New York slum families living in such inside rooms, where during the heat wave stagnant air hung for weeks at equatorial temperatures. Air shafts provided by the landlords to circumvent an 1879 ban on these rooms were used as garbage chutes, infecting the oven hot air with a rancid smell. In the slums, conditions were most pitiable. Seeking refuge outdoors from their furnace-like quarters, the poor lay in the alleyways in the streets where, according to a witness, the pavement was turned into a mass of fire in which the air quivers and palpitates. The nights brought no relief, only a still, sleepless languor filled with apprehension for what was going to happen in the morrow. Well, let's go out to Chicago and see what was happening back then. "Having seen it, I desire urgently never to see it again. Its air is dirt." Rudyard Kipling made these remarks about Chicago. a city that during the Gilded Age yielded nothing to New York in the breadth of its virulence of its pollution. Which, just a second here, let's see. Which city was dirtier was an academic question, but one visitor noted a difference in the character of Chicago's industry-created climate. Quote, the smoke was a peculiar aggressive individuality, unquote. It is possible that the observer was a romantic, attributing to Chicago's pollution the pugnacious emotional qualities that the city was noted for. However, its very location on the low prairie flats militated against the chance of becoming a healthy place to live in. In early Chicago, natural drainage was non-existent, flooding habitual, and the Chicago River fetid with grease so thick on its surface it seemed a liquid rainbow. The city tackled these problems with the buoyant spirit of the frontier, literally raising itself on pilings and vast landfills 7 to 12 feet above the prairie. Its population, only 5,000 souls in 1840, grew to a startling 1 million by 1890. The Great Fire of 1871 did not stop Chicago's blustering advance. Indeed, the fire and smoke it produced may have had a baptismal effect on its people, tempering them for the ordeal to come. As it grew during the 1870s into a major transportation center, with 8 railroads, a busy port, and heavy industry keeping apace, Chicago's pollution assumed a permanent, almost solid quality. Quote, during my stay of 1 week, I did not see in Chicago anything but darkness, smoke, clouds of dirt, unquote, reported the Italian dramatist Giuseppe Giancasso. Quote, one morning when I happened to be on the high railroad viaduct, the city seemed to smolder, a vast, unyielding conflagration, unquote. The largest assemblage of stockyards in the world added a pungent flavor to Chicago's air. Yeah, you remember that song or that book written by Sinclair Lewis about the stockyards in Chicago? What was the title? Maybe I'll think of it later. The largest, in fact, that book had more to do with cleaning up Chicago a lot than anything else. The largest assemblage of stockyards in the world added a pungent flavor to Chicago's air. The stockyards were the city's pride, and cities were constantly being dragged to see them. Visitors were. In fact, when I was about 10 or 12, we had a class trip, which we got on the train, and went to Chicago to tour the Swiss Armor stockyards and where they butchered all the meat, and it was I didn't want to eat meat for a long time after that. And I watched how they were made hot dogs, and I didn't eat hot dogs for a couple of years. After witnessing the disemboweling ceremonies, Lord Coleridge pleaded to be let outside or he never could eat sausage again. That's what I just said. A feature of the city's outlying district, you know, we went to on a class trip to Indianapolis to another butchering plant, big company. I forget which one it was. You'd recognize the name. I noticed it was almost all Negroes working in that plant. And it was the first time I had been around anything that had that many Negroes around. And I was really shocked at all the different colors of hair on Negroes. They were red-headed Negroes and all kinds, albinos, I'm telling you. A feature of the city's outlying districts, which lacked paved streets, was the sandstorms blown by the wind from Lake Michigan, stinging the eyes and making travel a hardship. A visitor remarked, quote, how a person can navigate this dirty city at night is a mystery to me, unquote. Yeah, the winds from Lake Michigan across Chicago can be very violent, and I can imagine in a polluted city how horrible it would be. Because of its assault on eye, ear, nose, and throat in the good old days, Chicago was rarely mentioned without the adornment of various uncomplimentary adjectives. Today it is known affectionately as the Windy City, and that is a monumental achievement. What about Pittsburgh? Well, at the turn of the century, Pittsburgh and its environs, along with the Monongahela Valley, boasted some 14,000 chimneys, most of them belonging to iron and steel plants, that provided a 24-hour barrage of soot, ashes, and glowing embers. A Hungarian visitor, Count V. de Vaya, described it as a noisome vomit, killing everything that grows, trees, grass, and flowers, unquote. The workers were hardly able to breathe in this atmosphere worthy of the Satan himself. And, you know, when I was in the Army, and I used to drive to New York across the Pulaski Skyway in 1956 or 7, it was horrible smell there, horrible smells. But since then, they have cleaned that up. And, of course, I was in Birmingham, Alabama, too, when my folks and I went to Florida one time, and we could smell all that coal and steel and everything in the air. It was beautiful to see at night, but it was not much to smell. Thousands, moreover, were compelled to live close to these factories in drab, unpainted shanties with smoke belching right through the windows, the backyards thick with mud and strewn with beer kegs and rubbish. No attempts was made to separate industry and human habitation. On the contrary, companies welcomed such proximity because it enabled them to exert tighter control over the working class. See that? Merely keeping clean became a problem in Pittsburgh, even for the middle class that lived apart from the industrial sections. Around 1900, the residents spent $1,500 on extra laundry work and $75,000 on a year for extra general cleaning, $750,000. According to Chamber of Commerce figures, Cincinnati had similar problems. People's hands and faces were constantly grimy. Clean collars quickly acquired a thick layer of soot, and the bituminous coal dust gave clothes hung out in the weekly wash a permanent yellow tinge. But Pittsburghers were not to be daunted. They pronounced the city one of the healthiest in the United States. People work so hard here they don't notice the smoke. Unquote. Contrary to the sanitized view that Hollywood gives us, Western towns are actually quite dirty, and so were the cowpokes who frequented them. The horses everybody had at least one, creating steamy cesspools around the hitching post, where the flies plagued man and beast and a vile odor abounded. Frequently, oxen and cattle contributed to the mess, and after a rainfall, the streets would fill with this yellow-brown ooze. Leadville, Colorado reported a morass in its main street, 18 inches deep, in which the wooden sidewalks formed a sort of raft, an ideal nest for rats. This mess seeped into pools to be pumped up as drinking water, so putrid it made liquor drinking a virtue. Pioneers trekked westward to breathe what they expected would be fresh air of small frontier towns. What they often encountered was air like that of a malaria swamp. Well, let's check on the traffic. Traffic and horsepower are indivisible. Today, horsepower fills the streets in mechanical disguise. In 1870, horsepower filled the streets with heavy, sweating substance. The horse, the cart, in one shape or another, spans much of the history of the 20th century and as principal means of land travel and principal cause of traffic jams. Both Julius Caesar and Grover Cleveland traveled by horse and cart, and almost 2,000 years after Caesar's imperial edict banned chariots, except those of the vestal virgins from Romans' clogged streets and cities of the New World, groaned under the press of wagon, beast, and man. Indeed, a study of the period suggests that the traffic jam as a monster spawned by civilization. I'm going to add something in here while I'm going along, because if I don't, I'll forget it. When I was in the Army in the mid to late 50s, and in Germany, stationed up on a mountain in the middle of nowhere, there were small villages around the mountain where they were still cultivating with an oxen and a horse. The guy was a real capitalist if he had a tractor. A lot of those people had land outside of town. They farmed, and they had a house in town. And in many cases, they had a manure pile in front of their house. In front of their house, and these were hilly little towns, and when the rains came, it would wash this dirty muck down the streets to where it got pretty stinky. And that was, like I say, in the mid to late 50s. One thing I could say for the American farmer, or most of them, they always had their manure pile out by the barn, and the barn was usually half a block, maybe a block from the house. They knew enough to keep it separate, which worked pretty good. So anyhow, little interjection there. Indeed, a study of the period suggests that the traffic jam as a monster spawned by civilization reached hideous proportions before the turn of the century. A traffic report from Lower Broadway in 1872, quote, "What a jam! Stages, carriages, cartmen, expressmen, pedestrians all melted together in one agglomerate mess," unquote. "All seemed to be driven by some frantic demon of haste," unquote. "Even the American cat was supercharged as though late for an appointment. To call a present-day traffic jam chaotic is not entirely accurate. It was too dormant, too regimented a quality about it. Chaos was the stuff of jams in the good old days, and there were no angry Caesars to cry halt. The horse car, inferno on wheels. The horse-drawn streetcar was a passenger's inferno and a pickpocket's paradise, a precaution suggested by one traveler. Before boarding a car, prudent persons leave their purses and watches in the safe deposit company and carry bowie knives and derringers. In winter, the streetcar became a rolling icebox, the stove on board more of a symbol than a threat to the frigid temperatures. Like the horses up front, the stove was chronically underfed. In the summer, the atmosphere was even more disagreeable. Fumes from unwashed bodies and beery breaths thickened an ambient stench of tobacco juice to a porridge of nausea. It's one problem I had with my stepfather. He always chewed tobacco, which I tried a couple of times and got sick. But he had a habit of, my mother drove most of the time, and he would have a swig of that tobacco, open up the side window and spit it out instead of putting it in a can. And sometimes that tobacco come back across the car, and if I had the window open in the back seat, I got some of it. Filthy habit it was. If the streetcar horses were notoriously maltreated, so too were the passengers. Although not flogged, they were commonly regarded as indistinguishable from freight. at rush hour is self-contradicting term since the crush of traffic precludes speed. Conductors loaded as many as 80 passengers into a car designed for 25. The buildup of pressure inside the car forced much of this human baggage through the window and door openings to cling to the sides like squid to a rock. However crowded the car, there were always room for one more. That sounds like these Asian streetcars and buses in South America, where they're still that way, with everybody on top of the full train. Streetcar owners encouraged their conductors to pack them in and took gleeful pride in the heavy strap hanger profits that tallied up at the year end. Greed, the great motivator. In 100 years from the 1870s to the 1970s, fear has changed partners on city streets. Today, while the pedestrian still grouses and the elderly admit mild fright, it is the driver who trembles at the thought of hitting a pedestrian. In the 1870s, it was the pedestrian who was terrified, with never a halt in the flow of traffic. On Broadway and other thoroughfares, the pedestrian faced such hazards in the riptide of commerce that his lot was little better than a deer in open season. Strangers were transfixed by the sight of the traffic-choked streets. Quote, "How to cross Broadway is one of the problems of life in New York," unquote, observed Holman Hearth in 1874. Quote, "Even the nimblest of New Yorkers stands on the curbstone and lays out a plan before marching across the thronged thoroughfare," unquote. The engine of city mayhem was the horse. Underfed and nervous, this vital brute was often flogged to exhaustion by pitiless drivers who exulted in pushing ahead with the utmost fury, defying law and delighting in destruction, unquote. Runaways were common. The havoc killed thousands of people. According to the National Safety Council, the horse-associated fatality rate was 10 times the car-associated rate of modern times. The absence of a public outcry against this chaos puzzled foreign observers. It did not seem logical that a spirited, pugnacious people could be complacent under such abuse. There was one practice, however, which provoked an uproar of protest. The steam railroads often laid track right through the center of town, thus creating another and more lethal crossing menace. Well, when I was a kid in the small town I lived next to, we had the what we call the urban streetcar, ran right through the center of town. I wish we still had it. And then it left our town and went down about 25 miles to another town where you could ride real cheap. But when Eisenhower was helping the automobile companies switch over everything from rail to cars and trucks, they paved over the rails here in this town I live next to, but underneath all the asphalt, layers and layers of asphalt, there's still brick streets with railroad irons in them. Railroad designers had a preoccupation with straight lines. Curved track incurred trouble and higher costs, and so new construction was laid through towns rather than around them. The owners saw nothing wrong in this because, in fact and in law, the towns belonged to them. The idle rich again. Actually, they weren't too idle. The railroad companies drew the map of the urban age. Altoona was a child of the Pennsylvania, and Lackawanna turned Slocum's Hole into Scranton, Pennsylvania. In the Iron Horse, the street horse, now had a rival in bloodletting, itself frequently the victim. Almost every town was marked by the X's of grade crossings, which were frequently the scene of fatal accidents, as they still are. because of stupid people, not because of safety lights. In 1 year, Chicago accounted for a record of 330 grade crossing deaths. In L.A., I'll tell you, the blacks are killed all the time going around the gates, lights flashing and everything. Philadelphia was a close second, while New York had only 124. At a Chicago crossing, 16 lives were lost in one accident. No one was punished. Aesthetically, the situation was equally bad, with locomotives adding their din, smoke, and vibrations to the ugliness and tension of urban America. Well, that's interesting, because at one point my parents rented a house that was only 50 feet from the East-West Pennsylvania Railroad. And every time the train went through, the house shook. But you get used to it. You can sleep right through it after a while. I remember all the guys coming home from World War II, these troop trains packed with guys all happy, waving out the windows and yelling. And I was a little kid sitting there by the tracks waving at them, and I thought that was really big stuff. But those Pennsylvania Railroad trains went through this town about 60, 70 miles an hour, I'm telling you. History tells us how Moses crossed the Sinai Desert with his people and that Caesar crossed the Rubicon with his men. But the pedestrian who successfully crossed the streets of yesterday's urban America is unremembered. There was simply no glory in it, only the certain knowledge that he would have to cross again. New York was made for street railways, not railways for New York. There were only two really happy days in the history of New York's famous L. The day the train started operation in 1868, and the day the dismantling was completed. Close to a century of confusion lay in between. How did it all come about? Well, in the 1870s and 1880s, the city meant New York, and New York meant Manhattan Island. Immigrants tumbled in by the thousands, descending as if by gravity to the lower half of the 9 by 2.5 mile slab in the estuary of the Hudson River. That was where the boats docked and the trains stopped. That was where the money flowed, where the opportunity knocked. But the crowding in lower Manhattan became intolerable. Of a total population of 942,292 in the city, 477,804 were squeezed into the area between 14th Street and City Hall. According to the census of 1870, unless an effective transportation system was provided to move people uptown, the city would collapse under the pressure. The elevated railroad became, for the better or for the worse, New York's vehicle of transit reform. The Gilbert Elevated Railway of 1868, running along Greenwich Street, was the first experimental piece of the system that was to become known as the L. Within a decade, it was joined by the 3rd Avenue Railroad in between City Hall and 42nd Street. And in the 1880s, many miles of New York's principal avenues were covered by streets on stilts. Sunlight was stifled, traffic frustrated by the hulking iron pillars, and in the semi-darkness, pedestrians cringed in fear of falling ashes, oil, and cinders. Ugly, dirty, depressing, the L became a blight on New York City. Aside from the smoke and the dust, the rattling and the screeching trains made buildings adjacent to the tracks tremble and created a noise so exasperating that it amounted to a positive pain. They became a monumental nuisance, marking, in Mumford's phrase, quote, the end of urban acceptability. Slow and unreliable, the trains played havoc with the traffic they were intended to relieve. During rush hours, as William Dean Howells described it, quote, every seat is taken, in the aisle people standing and swaying miserably, crushing together without regard for that personal dignity we prize, unquote. It is not clear whom the elevated railroads displeased most, those who traveled on them, those who walked under them, those who lived near them, but it is clear who liked them, their owners, the big shot, the ruling class, who with memorable impudence were moved to declare, quote, street railways were not made for New York, New York was made for street railways, unquote, as they raked in the dough. All in all, the effects of the L were not wholly negative. At best, it toughened New Yorkers for the future by teaching them the dangers of giving a public trust to those who could least be trusted. Well, that's about it for today, boys and girls. I hope you enjoyed my journey through the terrible times of America, and that doesn't even include the wars. I'll be back with you tomorrow to tell you some more terrible things about terrible America, the way it was, and you know how it is today, but we must admit it's a lot better than what it used to be.
The second time.